You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, the museum brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence.
We'd like to thank our great sponsors of today's SpyCast, Mack Weldon and ZipRecruiter.
We'd like to welcome Sherry's Berries to the SpyCast family.
Also, if you've ever wanted to show the world how cool you are by listening to SpyCast, or how wonderfully nerdy you are in my case, now you can. We have a shirt, and it's all kinds of awesome. And you can check it out at the Spy Museum retail shop online. Just go to spymuseum.org and click on Spy Shop at the top of the main page to see the new SpyCast shirt. Now let's meet our guests. We're joined today by Josh Kurlancic, who's a senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was previously a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he studied Southeast Asian politics and economics and China's relations with Southeast Asia, including Chinese investment aid and diplomacy. Before that, he was a fellow at the University of Southern California Center on Public Diplomacy and a fellow at the Pacific Council on International Policy. He's also served as a columnist for Time, a correspondent for The Economist based in Bangkok, a special correspondent for The New Republic, a senior correspondent for The American Prospect, and a contributing writer for Mother Jones. He also serves on the editorial board of Current History. He is a winner of the Lu Scholarship for Journalism in Asia and was selected as a finalist for the Osborne Elliott Prize for Journalism in Asia. His first book, Charm Offensive, How China's Soft Power is Transforming the World, was nominated for CFR's Council for Foreign Relations 2008 Arthur Ross Book Award. He's also the author of Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt in Middle Class in the Worldwide Decline in Representative Government, and the author of the new book, A Great Place to Have a War, The Secret War in Laos and the Birth of a Military CIA, which is what we're here today to talk about. So thank you, Josh, for taking the time to talk to us here at SpyCast.
Thanks so much for having me.
So whenever we have authors that are dealing with some kind of new information about the intelligence world, written a book that probably couldn't have been written before, I like to ask a little bit about kind of the origins and genesis of the book itself. What brought you to this idea in the first place, and why is now really the only time this book could have been written?
Well, I was a foreign correspondent in Southeast Asia in the late 90s and early 2000s, and what first brought me to it was I spent some time in Laos, and Laos was and still is, but even more than, a very sleepy and off-the-beaten-path place. And I was there seeing this and learning more and more about how only at that time, 25, 30 years earlier, this place had been a central focus for U.S. national security. And this seems almost so bizarre to me, having been in Laos at that time, that this place could be a focus of the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations. So that was the first point, that it was hard for me to understand how this transpired, how there could be such a significant conflict there. And then at the time, though, it was really hard to get information from the U.S. side, from the CIA side of the conflict, that the CIA became closely involved in there in 1961. And over the last 5 to 10 years, the agency has done a pretty good job of declassifying a lot of its Laos records. And putting them together in both on, because of declassification and from some pressure, and putting them together in a series of histories about the Laos era, and also collecting case studies from individual men who were case officers there. So it kind of became possible to tell this story in the past 5 to 10 years.
a key player in this story is also Thailand, where you spent a lot of time. Does it matter, or how much did it help you that Thailand itself kind of gave a government account of their efforts coordinating with CIA in Laos?
So, yeah, I mean, so one of the things that people really in the U.S. don't know much about the Vietnam War is that so Laos was, you know, one of the theaters of the Vietnam War, even though the conflict in Laos went basically unacknowledged by the U.S. government from 1961 until the late 60s, early 70s. But one of the things that most people don't know here is that Thailand was a pretty significant partner. You know, the bombing effort and air support effort in North Vietnam and to some extent in South Vietnam and in Laos as well was pretty much based out of Thailand. And many decisions were made out of Thailand. And in terms of the secret war in Laos, I like to call it the Twilight War, even though some people call it a secret war, because there were people in the U.S. who knew. There were Congress people who knew, but it was sort of murky and never really fully revealed to the public. But Thailand played a major role in sending commandos into Laos, in funding the Laos war, and in very strongly encouraging the U.S. to take a strong stand in Laos.
There are books about history, and as a historian, I certainly understand this, that people will find interesting but don't necessarily have any kind of current impact. And you've been getting a lot of critical acclaim for this book, and I think because it does have a lot of overlap with what we're looking at today, thinking about the increased militarization of CIA that a lot of people have looked at as a result of 9/11 and the response to 9/11. But this book really kind of highlights how it started much, much earlier than that. Do you think that's why, and this might be a loaded question, but let's say anyway, do you think that's why it's getting the kind of interest that a book on a sleepy country in Southeast Asia that no one really pays attention to would get otherwise?
Well, the first thing I would say is I hope it's getting interest because partly it's a book that should hopefully appeal to a general interest reader as well as someone who is interested in Asia or interested in the Vietnam War or interested in intelligence. It's written in a narrative style, almost like a film. So I hope that someone who's simply interested in good narrative nonfiction, like if you liked a book about the Comanches and Quanah Parker, just because it's good narrative nonfiction, even though you had no particular background knowledge about Quanah Parker or the Comanches or Texas, which is which I didn't, but it was a good, well-written book. I hope that this will entertain you. So I think there's that first. But definitely the book has two themes. One is simply to retell the Laos War, and second is to look at the major shift in the CIA that happened during the Laos War, the empowerment of the CIA, and the shift from making spying and intelligence work, what was thought of as traditional intelligence work, to military training and aid, essentially paramilitary operations, a much more central focus. It existed to some extent before, but it became much more central. And so I do think that that has direct significant relevance for today. And we can talk about the overlap. The CIA was reformed in the 70s, and some of these efforts were shut down, but not completely. But many of the things that you see today, you can see in the Laos War. The elevation of paramilitary in the CIA, the empowerment of paramilitary officers, and the significant lack of oversight, yet at the same time handing a lot of sort of war-type responsibilities to the agency rather than U.S. conventional forces. Right. So that has a lot of parallels today.
Well, one of the things that makes this an interesting narrative is that there are some quite interesting and very important historical figures in this book that many people may have never heard of. And I'm wondering if you can give us a brief bio on them to kind of set things up, because names like Bill Lehrer and Tony Poe may not be household names, but they play such a key role in telling this story. And it's really on the backs of these characters, if you want to call them that, that this narrative plays out. And I think that's exactly what you're kind of talking about, that it's the narrative structure is different than a standard history book. So let's start with Bill Lehrer, because he really seems to be central to this story. Can you give us a little bit of background on Bill?
So Bill Lehrer was a guy who, a Texas guy who joined the CIA not long after the Second World War, a few years later. And he really acclimated to Southeast Asia and really became sort of one of these types who almost kind of went native, which was sort of a, the CIA was of two minds about this, but he fit in very well in Southeast Asian culture and Thai culture, Lao culture. Thailand and Laos are neighbors and share some cultural traits, and the language is similar. And he really saw that the CIA could play a role in what was already a civil war in Laos, but he was very much of the mindset that the CIA, the U.S., had to support a war that was run and managed by local people, with the U.S. as playing a role of aiding, but that it should be local people basically fighting for their own land, and it should not be a quote-unquote American fight. And he also saw the U.S. as kind of playing the role of supporting democracy in these places, but it had to be what local people wanted. So it was all based on some successes that had been had in the Philippines and Malaysia before. He would go on as the war in Laos became bigger and bigger and more Americanized and less really in local people's interests, become increasingly disillusioned, and ultimately, I don't want to get too far ahead, but it would not turn out well for him or for a lot of people in Laos. But Bill Lehr was basically the person who came up with the idea for the covert operation in Laos.
Well, his contemporary on the Laotian side was a man named Vang Pao, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, who is quite a character. This is somebody who, you know, doesn't have the traditional background of a military commander, but become incredibly important not only in the American prosecution of this war, but also in broader politics when it comes to Laos and Southeast Asia.
So Vang Pao was basically a Hmong young man who had spent, by the time that the CIA, that the war really ramped up in 1961, I mean, CIA was involved in Laos before that, certainly. Vang Pao basically already spent his entire adolescent and adult life at war. Pretty much that was all he did or had known how to do. I mean, France, he fought with the French in the First Indochina War against North Vietnam, against Viet Minh, against Vietnamese communist nationalist forces that were making incursions into Laos. And he had won a lot of acclaim from French officers for his fighting skills. And the CIA, the U.S. and CIA, they were looking for local officers to work with. And the national armed forces, the Royal Laotian Armed Forces, were riddled with corruption and not very effective. And so they saw in Vang Pao this kind of hill tribe, rugged local general who they thought could be not only an effective military commander, but kind of like a powerful local leader who they could invest in. And indeed, the CIA wound up investing very, very, very heavily in him, and he became the whole center of the operation, to some extent to the operation's detriment, but yeah.
You talked about him being a Hmong, and I think that's important that we lay that foundation also.
Right.
For those of you who don't know what we're saying, we're actually pronouncing a word that's spelled H-M-O-N-G. It's the Hmong people I'll let you talk about a little bit, but those who have studied Vietnam, there is a bit of an overlap to the Montagnards, perhaps, of the Vietnam side. But give a little bit of background about these people, because a lot of the listeners could be living near one of them today, because many of them came to the United States after the war. And the Hmong civilization is one that, you know, was American allies till the very end.
Right. So, I mean, there are a number of so-called hill tribes in different parts of Southeast Asia, which is a name for a number of different ethnic minority groups who live in the uplands of Southeast Asia, and is a broad generalization, but they have tended to be minorities in most of the modern-day countries. And also, in Laos, there is a significant population of these Hmong, but the government, there was a royal government and then a French royal government, they tended to be looked down on by the lowland people who make up the majority and tended to try to live in sort of clan-type structures. And the most important thing in terms of as the war went on, is they didn't want communist government. Most of them didn't want communist government. Mostly they both really kind of just wanted to be left alone. And the Hmong had also fought in many wars going back. And so they were sort of like, in some ways, for an outside power like the U.S. or Thailand, the ideal allies in what was a communist versus non-communist war. They didn't, the Hmong weren't in love with the royalist non-communist government in the capital of Laos, but they saw it as a way to protect their freedoms and that they would be more left alone. So you have like people who are a minority people, historically had been discriminated against, were pretty, very knowledgeable about the rugged terrain where they lived, had a lot of experience fighting, had proven that they could fight, kind of had a chip on their shoulder with some reason against both Vietnamese and the Laotian communists, and were pretty desperate for aid. So this
the
made
perfect
kind of,
partner, right? Anne?
Yeah, potentially makes a perfect partner. And Vang Pao was one of the few Hmong people at that time who had worked with the French at a high level, worked with French officers who spoke some French. So he was a person the U.S. could deal with.
We will return to this conversation in a moment. But first, let me tell you about gifts like no other for your love like no other. There's no one like your Valentine. This year, treat them to an unforgettable gift that's as unique as they are. Now, for anyone in a long-term relationship, Valentine's Day can be taxing, mainly because you don't want to repeat the same old gifts from years past. The same old, tired, I didn't really try that hard this year, dear gifts. And a gift from Sherry's Berries shows her you put thought into finding the perfect gifts. Now, these berries are decadent, fresh, juicy, sweet, shareable, and irresistible. You can choose berries dipped in tempting white, milk, and dark chocolate goodness. You can also have things topped with chocolate chips, decorative swizzles, and chopped nuts. Surprise her at her office and workplace. Her coworkers are sure to be just a little jealous, and she'll be overjoyed. And you have options. Choose a gift from Sherry's Berries' incredible collection of gifts. Your gift will be perfectly packaged in a gift box with all the details taken care of. Sherry's Berries will deliver your gift fresh and on time, guaranteed, or your money back. And look, I'd like to add something here for our female listeners. This copy is designed to entice men to buy these, but we guys love Sherry's Berries as well. Just saying. So freshly dipped strawberries from Sherry Berries starting at just $19.99 plus shipping, or double the berries for just $10 more. Just go to berries.com and use our code SPYCAST. That's BERRIES.com and use our code SPYCAST. With Valentine's Day right around the corner, there's only one way to get Sherry's Berries starting at $19.99. Again, that's berries.com, BERRIES.com. Click on the microphone in the top right-hand corner and type in SPYCAST. That's berries.com and use our code SPYCAST. By doing this, you can help support our show by supporting our sponsors. Again, use the code SPYCAST. Let me ask you about Bill Sullivan, because he seems to be an a-stereotypical State Department official. He's somebody who... it's interesting to me because you constantly hear about the bad relationship between the State Department and CIA. But he was somebody, as a diplomat, he was the ambassador there, who truly embraced working with CIA, even more than with the U.S. military. He didn't like working with the military, but he liked working with the CIA. Can you talk a little bit about him?
So Bill Sullivan was a career diplomat. Some people may know him a little bit outside of Laos context because he was also the U.S. ambassador in Tehran when in the period around the time that the Shah fell and the revolution happened, although he wasn't still there when the hostages were taken. He came to Laos in the mid-60s as a pretty young ambassador, but very confident. And it was a very, very unique situation in U.S. foreign policy. The covert operation started in 1961 had already ramped up significantly and was on its way to include training of tens of thousands of people, a number of CIA operatives in the field even doing some, not supposed to do this, but were doing some local battlefield commanding, and then a significant bombing operation as well. And Bill Sullivan, although he would sort of deny this, but basically embraced many aspects of that. He was handling many aspects of the war planning and oversight along with the CIA station chief in the Lao capital and the CIA station in Northeast Thailand. He was working with them to basically manage a war effort, which is almost unprecedented in State Department history. And at the same time, they very much wanted to keep U.S. military commanders off of their turf. And he saw the CIA as a more natural ally in this, and they did not want the conventional forces officers on their turf. They kept the military officer who was supposed to be basically providing advice for the war. They kept him in Bangkok. They tried to keep him in Bangkok as much as possible. They tried to not have him come to Laos. They kept him to basically what one historian called, he was wound up essentially as a clerk. They later kept William Westmoreland, who was the commander of, basically the commander of all U.S. and allied forces in the Vietnam theater for a time. They basically kept him out of the Laos operation as well, too. So there was a lot of enmity between the CIA and state and the armed forces. And Bill Sullivan definitely played a major role in that enmity.
So Sullivan had a great working relationship with CIA. Did this change at all when a new CIA station chief arrived that people may have actually heard of?
Yeah.
Somebody very famous working in Miami and then later in Vietnam, Ted Shackley. A different kind of character than what Bill Lehrer was before him.
So Bill Lehrer wasn't the station chief in Laos. He was basically he was running the operation out of Thailand. There was a different station chief in Laos before Shackley came. But that station chief before Shackley very much deferred to Bill Lehrer as the expert on Southeast Asia, as the expert on the Hmong people. And the station chief before Shackley also was, he sort of shared Bill Lehrer's concept of a war led by Laotian people with the U.S. somewhat in the background, and also that if you didn't do it to some extent the Laotian way, it wouldn't work. Ted Shackley was very, very different. He was very much like, although he wasn't from the Department of Defense, he very much shared the kind of best and the brightest McNamara efficiency American style. Like, be at your meetings exactly on time, if not early, have a million meetings, take a million notes, do everything in a certain very highly rigorous way. Just not really the way a lot of stuff gets done in Thailand and Laos. But he had a very different idea of what the war would be, but he got along well with Sullivan. He did not get along well with Bill Lehrer or even with Vang Pao, but he and Sullivan got along well, and they transformed the war in a very dramatic way, and one that many of the people like Lehrer, many of the CIA folks like Lehrer, were not happy about at all.
I mean, we know a little bit about the Laotian War here at the Spy Museum because we work with an organization that actually takes some of the unexploded ordnance and turns them into jewelry to help build schools and other things like that. So we have an idea, but not a super great idea. And I think like some other more familiar places like Vietnam, or unlike more familiar places like Vietnam, people may not understand why Laos was considered a priority for the United States. And until they hear the fact it's basically a priority as far as I could read, because it became a priority for the Soviets. It kind of became this Cold War battlefront and the zero-sum game between the Soviets and the United States. And I get it's next to Thailand even more than Vietnam is. But is Laos something that can be considered by anyone to be an essential American interest?
Okay, well, a couple of things there.
Yeah. Laos, I know I tacked a lot of things on one.
Laos question, wasn't a priority for the Soviets at that time. Let's just go back a little bit and untangle a few things. Laos had already been for the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations a concern, but it was prompted by the idea that after China became communist, there was panic in the U.S. foreign policy establishment that China and then Vietnam and then other Asian countries were going to become communist. Indeed, Vietnamese communists had made major incursions into Laos, but the Soviets weren't that closely involved in Laos. They played a role, but it was not that great a role. One of the fallacies of American foreign policy at that time was understanding some of the differences between different communist movements. But I think what happened was you had this place that had seemed to fit the idea of the domino theory that you couldn't let more countries, particularly in Asia, fall to communism perfectly because it was wedged between near China, between Vietnam and Thailand. And the pressure on the Eisenhower administration saw this place as kind of like a place to make a stand against communism, and for Kennedy as well. A second aspect about why it was a priority is that Laos was a place that both Eisenhower and Kennedy saw as kind of an ideal place to have a covert operation that could make a difference. There were some ideas presented by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to Kennedy to have an actual conventional war in Laos with U.S. troops, but those were shot down. But Kennedy, who was very much loved the idea of covert operations, even after Bay of Pigs, saw Laos as a place where a covert operation could make a big difference, and without having to commit conventional forces. He was still somewhat skeptical about conventional forces in Southeast Asia, although obviously ultimately he led the way to significant introduction of them. So for those two reasons, that no one would argue in any way that today, I mean, there are people in D.C. would argue this, but Laos is not a priority interest in the United States today.
Yes, you said several times that Laos was a priority, and I want to ask you if it's fair to say you're somewhat underselling that. The way you write in the book is that with historical hindsight, Vietnam would be considered the U.S.'s number one priority in Southeast Asia, but that wasn't true at first. You write several times that Laos, by the Eisenhower-Kennedy transition period, was the number one Southeast Asian priority.
Right, so there was a coup in Laos in 1960, and the civil war flared up into kind of chaos. And Vietnam was a little bit more stable at that time. And Eisenhower, in the transition period after Kennedy's election, made Laos the top topic of conversation in the foreign policy briefing in the transition period. And he viewed Laos in that way. And Kennedy spent his first foreign policy-related press conference talking about Laos. And indeed, as I talk about in the book, the press coverage of Laos in the New York Times and some other outlets reflects this in 1960-1961. There's far more time devoted to Laos than Vietnam. And this coup in Laos, which is not totally relevant to our story, but a little bit, because what it did was it created turmoil in this country, and the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations didn't really have a good bead on was communism going to spread into Laos? Who were these people who led the coup? Were they actually even communists? And so in an environment of really not good information and already kind of ramped up domino theory and as well as fear, you have the possibility for a pretty significant reaction. And that's partly why they went forward with covert action. And it's probably why someone even put on the table the idea that there should be significant actual conventional war in Laos, although Kennedy did reject that. So, yeah, at the beginning there, it was a very, very high priority. And simply the fact that throughout the entire 1960s, so much aid money, so much bombing was spent in Laos shows that although it retreated to not as important as Vietnam once U.S. troops were actually on the ground in Vietnam, it was still a very significant foreign policy priority.
Skipping ahead a little bit, what made me interested in this concept of the dynamic of CIA running a war, which is really what we're looking at here, was the Nixon administration, which has traditionally, and this is pretty famous within intelligence historians, had a horrible relationship with CIA. But Nixon and Kissinger were perfectly fine in leaving the war up to CIA and letting them run this without any real impact on top. Was this because it was a great place to go communist? Was this because the American people didn't seem to care all that much, that he didn't have to worry about any kind of backlash? Was he looking at Vietnam broader strategically? I mean, Nixon and Kissinger were very big strategic thinkers, and the Laos War helped to prevent North Vietnamese from, you know, giving full attention to Vietnam. I'm throwing a lot at you. I just want to... To me, it seemed like an interesting dynamic, because the guy who historically distrusted CIA, didn't get along with the director, lets them run an entire war in a country next to Vietnam, which is the number one foreign policy priority.
Right. So, I mean, I think there's a lot there. I mean, so certainly Nixon disliked Richard Helms intensely, and I read CIA's declassified internal biography of the CIA under DCI Helms, and, Helms was prepared for Nixon to intensely dislike him, and he certainly was aware of 1960 and the 1960 election, and that Nixon felt that CIA had essentially aided Kennedy by someone in CIA providing information about the alleged, although not true, missile gap. And so Helms was under no illusions. And, of course, Nixon didn't like Helms and some of the other CIA leaders because he viewed them as kind of the traditional Washington elite that he was very scornful of. But for a few reasons, I think they allowed CIA to continue to and to expand the Laos War. Well, one was the war was very, very unknown among most of the U.S. public. And although Nixon disliked Helms, he also loved being able to conduct operations in secrecy. And in fact, even when the war was brought out more to the U.S. public through a series of revelations by some activists who worked in Laos and some senators pushing a little harder, there still wasn't really that much public interest. I talk in the book about how there was very little public interest, not even, let's talk about Vietnam, but even compared to Cambodia. When Nixon bombed Cambodia, you know, there was a huge protest in the U.S., but after revelations about the scale and the scope of the bombing in Laos and some pushing on it by Senator Ted Kennedy and others, there was still very little U.S. response.
Which is extraordinary because, as we'll talk about in a second, the effort in Laos was dramatically larger than it was other places. In the revelations of the secret bombing in Cambodia, you got Kent State. I mean, you had some pretty dramatic backlash. Let's get into that a little bit. People may not quite understand the scale of what we're talking about here. And you write it in the book, and this is the biggest operation in CIA history.
Right. It's the biggest covert operation in CIA history. Just to go back to Nixon for one second, I also would say that one of the things that happened was late in Johnson and then going into Nixon is that the war in Laos changed a lot, and this is what alienated people who had been sort of on the Hmong side at the beginning. It changed from a war to a conflict where the U.S. was trying to help local people, at least in their conception, that's what they were trying to do, defend their land while not, giving them basically the priority was them defending their land in the way that was most effective. And that way was a guerrilla concept supported by the U.S. Under Shackley and then even more intensively when Nixon became president, the war in Laos transformed, and the Hmong were mostly Hmong, but there were others, but into basically a body count war, a charnel house war, where the U.S. was the goal for the U.S. at least was to kill as many North Vietnamese who were fighting in Laos, and they were intensely involved in Laos as possible, so that those same North Vietnamese who were the best trained, the toughest, most effective army in Southeast Asia and ultimately defeated two major powers in the space of 30 years, kill as many of them as possible, no matter the consequences for Laos or your own Laotian allies. So what happened was Vang Pao and his men changed from fighting a lot of guerrilla engagements that they were actually quite good at to being put into conventional wars, conventional battles in open plains, in open areas, and that was it did kill a lot of North Vietnamese, but that was disastrous for the Hmong and for Vang Pao's fighters because they just couldn't keep up with the body count.
Well, and really, the only option there for the Americans is to increase the bombing campaign, which is, you know, it goes from a top secret clandestine secret war using hit and run tactics to essentially a World War II era flatten everything with carpet bombing.
So the bombing campaign, which began in a small way in the mid-60s, developed into a massive campaign. So not only was Laos the largest covert operation in CIA history, in U.S. history, the country of Laos, which is, you know, a very small country, you know, I mean, smaller than California, I mean, with a population at that time less than 5 million, was bombed more heavily than Germany and Japan combined in the Second World War. It was being bombed. Ordnance was being dropped once every 8 minutes for years over Laos. And the bombing campaign, which at the beginning Vang Pao encouraged, after some time it didn't really have a lot of clear intent. I mean, some of the intent was to take out North Vietnamese targets and Laotian communist targets. Some of the intent was to cut the North Vietnamese lines to South Vietnam. So there were some real strategic intents, but Laos is a country with minimal infrastructure, right. with few towns. And the North Vietnamese had were not exposed in most places, and so there was little clear rules for bombing, and no sanction for missing what was even supposed targets. And many times, bombers who took off from Thailand on missions over Laos or to Vietnam that didn't either find their target, or they had gone in to bomb in Vietnam and hadn't found a target, would just release bombs over Laos just so they didn't have to land back with bombs. In some ways, the bombing became an end in itself. Administration officials would declare internally that the war was going well because they had dropped so much tonnage of bombs, the war was going better because the number of bombing runs had increased.
And you write that there were 580,000 bombing runs during the war in Laos, which, again, seems extraordinary. And you said the statistic of an average of one bombing run every 8 minutes for an entire decade. That seems not like a CIA clandestine war to me.
Right. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, so a couple things. First of all, like I said, even CIA folks and people in the U.S. intelligence community who went along with this the war and continuing it began to see that the bombing itself, although there were some strategic goals, was well beyond what could be possibly construed as making strategic sense, and was counterproductive in many ways. The first most obvious way, it destroyed the civilian population of Laos. Whole areas of the country were utterly destroyed. The country today is still pocked and landmarked with bombs. Its infrastructure is still challenged by unexploded ordnance.
Yeah, I mean, you write that many of the things dropped were anti-personnel mines,
yeah,
that a third of the bombs don't detonate.
Right.
3 decades after the war ended, unexploded ordnance would maim or kill tens of thousands of Laotians. And even today, they're still dealing with that.
Right. So the second... second thing is, at the beginning of the conflict, that the Laotian communist forces were not particularly popular, but the repeated massive bombing drove away sentiment and support for Vang Pao and his fighters, who relied on public support, like any domestic army. But the third thing, in terms of it being clandestine or no longer clandestine. One impact it did have was it drove tens of hundreds of thousands of people out of areas and into the capital of Laos. And at that point, because the bombing had been so wide and now there were so many refugees, American journalists who really had little access, or foreign journalists who really had little access to most of Laos, where the secret war had been taking place, because refugees were now coming in, streaming into the capital and telling stories of massive bombing, it did begin to get a significant amount of news coverage, and that's ultimately what prompted hearings and Kennedy and others on the Foreign Relations Committee to probe why was the U.S. in Laos, what was happening. So the extent that there was media coverage and U.S. interest, which was still much less than Vietnam or Cambodia, and we could talk about why that is, but that bombing did have some impact and led to that. But yeah, I mean, the bombing could, on moral grounds and strategic grounds, I mean, there's just no justification.
We'll have more of this in a second, but now I want to tell you about ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is a company that was founded by a group of guys who worked in the tech industry and with startups and realized that the absolute worst thing about running an organization was the process of hiring people. Look, we open the new museum next year, and we're hiring people to work on exhibit development, research, and more. And we will eventually need to hire a lot more people as we get closer to the opening. When we need to hire a new person, we want to get the very best people, and who doesn't? But the process seems never-ending, and it can take a huge amount of time we don't have, as we try to run our current operation while planning the content for the new museum. The people at ZipRecruiter have the solution. So are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can.
With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 200-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. There's no juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. So find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Right now, SpyCast listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's ZipRecruiter.com/first. One more time to get it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/first.
When you look at the annual budget, which, again, for a secret war that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, is extraordinary, you write that $500 million in 1970s money, which you equate to over $3 billion a year today. I mean, that's a major war.
Yep. I mean, the money went also, I mean, so one of the reasons why it was a major conflict, and the agency's budget for the war grew significantly. The number of contractors, helicopter pilots, plane pilots, grew significantly. And an entire apparatus for the war grew up. I mean, not just your actual CIA-employed operatives, some of whom were working in the field with Van Pau, but USAID ramped up because the United States is now feeding a lot of the Hmong because they were being driven into a few areas of the country where they were out of their traditional land. So there was massive food drops to them, air drops, weapons drops. The bases in northeast Thailand, where the air campaigns were based, were built up into massive operations. So everything expanded significantly. And for most of this time, until late 60s, early 70s, there were a couple senators who knew about the extent of the war, and a few Congress people who would go up to Laos and get like a 1 or 2 day kind of Potemkin visit with Van Pau and others, but no one really pressed too hard. And in some of the ways, it's similar, I think, to congressional oversight of some of our current wars today. I mean, there's several reasons. I mean, one is, you know, in most of the Laos War, unlike obviously in the Vietnam War, there were Americans dying. More than 700 Americans died. But most of them were contractors or CIA operatives. So the news of their death did not resonate with the American public, either because they and their family agreed not to tell anyone about it, which was they accepted as part of the deal, or simply because it didn't come in such large numbers, mm-hmm. like in the actual Vietnam theater. So for a long time, Congress kind of just went along with it.
You use the term Potemkin Village, which I thought was a really humorous part of the book, where you talk about how when members of Congress would come, Vang Pao would meet them in almost a fake headquarters that had nothing to do. It was just set up for VIP visits.
Right. So, I mean, some congressmen, it was almost all men at that time, took an interest, but they would bring them up to Laos, and they would meet with Vang Pao, who was a very charismatic figure, kind of looked like a general, and he was a general in the army by then, you know, and wore fatigues and a marine hat and was very outgoing. But they wouldn't usually bring them to the actual base where Vang Pao and the CIA were running their operations in Long Ching, which is a place in Laos, which had turned into, by that time, by the late 60s, a massive base with airstrips, anti-aircraft, tens of thousands of mostly Hmong who had come and fled to be near the base because war was raging in other places. There was, like, Thai commandos there, a few foreign mercenaries, CIA, and so it was a major, major operation. But the Congress people who came would usually be skirted past that, so that it looked like Vang Pao was really running everything without any CIA involvement. And taken to another village where they would be shown kind of Vang Pao running everything, or just kind of welcomed by a few Lao women and then had an overnight and flown back. Very rarely were they ever allowed to see really the specifics of how the operation was commanded and the extensive presence of CIA there.
A lot of smoke and mirrors, so they don't really understand
right.
how much America's involved.
And I should say from their part, I mean, there were senators who knew, but they really didn't want to know more. Oh. There were some who I think were brought up and were shown this, and that was enough. And there was others who really didn't. And they only changed their mind and wanted to really know more or know what they already really knew. They wanted to actually know it publicly. When the American public sentiment became more expressly anti-war in the late 60s and early 70s, although even then, Laos was still less a priority. So there were senators who just didn't want to know what they could have known.
Before we talk about the broader argument, the impact of Laos for further CIA operations, I want to ask you about a quote that you have in the book from a U.S. general who argued that there would have been at least 10,000 more Americans killed in Vietnam if it wasn't for the war in Laos, and not to justify any kind of any of the humanitarian loss or anything else, which you can't do. How realistic is that? I mean, how much of an impact did the war in Laos have on the broader fight in Vietnam? I know it's a counterfactual. I know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, a counterfactual, it's hard to answer. I mean, certainly, at different points in Vietnam, in Laos, the North Vietnamese, Hanoi sent groups of some of its most experienced divisions and Vang Pao and other parts of the Laotian armed forces, but engaged with them and tied them down to some extent. I mean, the CIA sort of looked back at the Laos war after it was over, argued that the war was a success in some ways, and that success came in several kind of flavors. And certainly there's a clear argument that the war was a success for the CIA in that it elevated the CIA's role in policymaking, put them clearly at the table alongside state and defense as important policymakers, and created a paramilitary branch, made it much stronger. But the CIA's own internal assessment argues that the same thing, that it was essentially that it was a success because it tied down North Vietnamese and to some extent Laotian, but North Vietnamese communist forces who would have otherwise been in South Vietnam. I mean, it is true. I mean, I don't know if it's 10,000 or not.
And I'm not trying to make any kind of value judgment. I'm just trying to see if anything that was done made a difference.
I guess I don't know how to answer that counterfactual. I mean, I think Bill Lehr would have said that if your goal was to harass and tie down the North Vietnamese as long as possible in Laos, it probably still would have been better to keep equipping the Hmong and Vang Pao as a guerrilla force and keep them launching guerrilla attacks against the North Vietnamese and Laotian communists rather than wasting so many of them in conventional battles they couldn't win. And maybe you could have tied them down longer. But I
understand it's not a fair question. I mean, you could also make the counter-argument that the 580,000 bombing runs on Laos would have been better used on Vietnam, or the $3.1 billion a year better used for Vietnam. But I just wanted to – that was an interesting quote that you included. I just wanted to see what you thought about it. No matter what store-bought clothing you've been using in the past, Mack Weldon is better than whatever you're wearing right now, and will be the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, shorts, polos, and sweatpants that you'll ever own. And now that it's truly winter, it's worth checking out the Mack Weldon Merino products and their Ace Crew sweatshirt. The Merino line is not your grandma's wool. The custom fabric blend creates a garment that is soft, lightweight, antimicrobial, moisture-wicking, thermoregulating, and wrinkle-resistant. The difference between Merino wool and grandma's wool is that fibers from Merino sheep are the finest on earth, making them incredibly soft and lightweight. Merino wool is a truly remarkable fabric. It's the softest, lightest, and most breathable wool in existence. It adjusts to the needs of your body temperature and smells fresh for days, making it the ideal base layer for everything from cold urban commuting to hitting the ski slopes to crawling under the covers at night. It's truly daily wear, all thanks to a sheep in the Southern Alps of New Zealand. Then there is the crew sweatshirts, which have received a modern makeover where versatility meets comfort. Made for life indoors and outdoors, to be worn under or over other items to create a refined layered look. slim fit, super soft loop back French terry, and signature details that go the extra mile. Wear them anywhere. Seriously. And of course, Mack Weldon will always have the try-on guarantee, hassle-free returns, and free shipping on orders over $50. Mack Weldon is reinventing men's basics. Smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. So go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using the promo code SPYCAST. That's MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using the promo code SPYCAST. Let's go to the 30,000-foot view. And one of the broad arguments that you're making in here that maybe is what's getting a little pushback, but I want to get your take on it, is that the Laotian operation, which we actually haven't even said, it was called Operation Momentum. We haven't even said that. Really serves as the template for other CIA paramilitary action which comes after it, which is a lot, you know, since 1960. Do you want to kind of work your way through that? Because there's a lot of elements to it, but I think that it's the most interesting argument to me. I'm sold on it to a degree, but I'd like to hear what kind of how you lay it out.
Sure. I mean, I don't want to argue that it's the template for exact template. I mean, because things change, but it was the operation that did several things. It elevated the folks in CIA who were focused on paramilitary operations, and many of whom had been in the military or special forces rather than folks who were in intelligence work and not in paramilitary side, who at that time had been very much an old boys network, had come a lot of them from a background in Ivy League and in analytical work. It made those branches more equal. It dramatically expanded the CIA's budget far, far, far beyond it had ever had before. And even after the reforms of the 70s, which downsized paramilitary and cut the CIA's budget and enacted reforms, not because of the Laos War, but because of all these other things mm-hmm. that we know about, the budget never went back down in consistent for today's numbers to the way it was before the Laos War. It created a mindset within CIA that this is a type of operation that the agency could do, which on this scale had never been done before. And it was, even in 1975, even in 1977, even in 1979, after communist forces had taken Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, and CIA had encountered pushback from the Ford and Carter administrations, it was still regarded and written up as a major success for the agency. And I think it still is for those who look at it. So it made paramilitary operations a major focus of the agency. It also, not uncoincidentally, trained a generation of officers who might otherwise have been, in intel work in Berlin or in intel work in Mexico City. It took a generation of officers, highly skilled people, and they made their bones in Laos. And those folks learned that this is something the CIA could do. And some of them went on to major important posts in operations. Some of them were involved in Central America in the 80s. Some of them worked with the Mujahideen in the 80s. Some of them were still around after 9/11. So there was a direct sort of message that was sent, but there was also a generation of people. I mean, this was a war that went on with CIA assistance for 12 years, so a whole generation of folks. We can talk, and then, I mean, you can cut me off, but I was going to say about in terms of, it also sort of established a pattern of problematic oversight.
Yeah, I was going to say no Congress, no.
So the war went on, and one thing that we saw here was that it was possible to, we're not talking about a training program for anti-communist Chinese fighters or even a Bay of Pigs type situation, but a 12-year extended twilight war with an enormous budget and very, very, very significant casualties. Even it's over 700 American casualties. That's nothing to be sniffed at, and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of domestic casualties. Bombing that is done and minimal oversight. So a message is sent that this is possible, which I think is very, very relevant to what's happened in the last 15 years, in which the CIA has again sort of taken up the kind of the way of the knife, to mention the book by Mark Mazzetti, mm-hmm. but and the way of the knife in which the CIA is used not only or not exclusively or not even primarily as a intelligence gathering operation, but as a war or as a killing organization, that really traces its roots to Laos. And there are some other specific elements as well, but I mean, I think in that way the pattern was set. And I think you see in today in a very similar environment as you had in the early parts of the Laos War, you have a U.S. public that's, I wouldn't say the U.S. I'm not sure, actually, right now, but I wouldn't say the U.S. public is isolationist, but you have a very high degree of isolationist sentiment in the U.S. public today, at least in polling. But at the same time, there's enormous fear of certain types of terrorism. There's enormous fear of Islamist terrorism. But people still remember the Iraq War, the Afghanistan Wars, et cetera. So you have a somewhat similar situation in the early 60s when the Korean War had just recently happened. It was a bloody, brutal stalemate. The U.S. public wasn't really that excited for another conventional war, although they wound up having another conventional war. But yet there was this pretty intense ideological fear, and a covert war really sort of fit in effectively.
So one of the things that really jumped out at me that you talk about details that were similarities between what the CIA did in Laos and what we're looking at today, and this might sound familiar to a lot of the listeners out there also, is the widespread use of contractors in the war in Laos, because that is something that, you know, whether it's Blackwater or anybody else, the CIA and the American government uses pretty extensively today. That's not just in the paramilitary side, certainly in the intelligence collection analysis side too. Edward Snowden comes to mind. This is widespread in the war in Laos. Is this something that comes out of nowhere? Is this something that Laos is kind of the catalyst for? Can you talk a little bit about the use of contractors in this war?
Yeah, I mean, I think in many ways Laos was the catalyst. A very small number. I mean, the Air America derived from a previous airline. But in terms of the use of contractors, the much more widespread use of contractors as spotters for airstrikes, as pilots, as providing aid and others, Laos was a really big game compared to anything the CIA had done before. And as the war ramped up, the agency and those in the military who were also working with it, and they just didn't have the manpower to backstop such a significant operation. In terms of pilots, in terms of helicopter pilots, in terms of the quote-unquote, the so-called ravens, which are the people who went into Laos and called in strikes, and people to serve on the ground in Laos. So a massive contractor hiring sort of experiment began and ramped up, and mostly out of Thailand, but in other places as well. And again, it was sort of a twilight effort, not a secret effort. They were advertising in the English language newspapers in Thailand in a very thinly veiled way for contractors to work in the war effort. So it wasn't exactly secret, but it was sort of pseudo secret. But this was really the beginning of the really, really widespread use of contractors in this type of operation.
They weren't taking out ads in the New York Times, but they were reaching out to some ex-military types roaming around.
Right, yeah. Asia. And I mean, then as now, because, I mean, Bangkok had a lot of ex-military types. There were people who had finished their tours in Vietnam. Once the actual Vietnam conventional conflict started going, there were a lot of folks who would do a tour, and then for whatever reason, they wanted to stay, or they liked Southeast Asia or whatever, so they were hiring a lot of people out of Bangkok, or a lot of expats living in Bangkok. And but the point is that it wasn't really hidden. One other thing I just want to mention about that, it was problematic because with the actual CIA folks who were operations folks who were working in Laos, increasingly they were hiring people who had a lot of training and military background. It shifted. They stopped necessarily hiring so many without. But a lot of the contract, or a fair number of the contractors who were being hired, communications folks, some Ravens, some others, weren't given a great amount of training. And there was a couple of times that I chronicle in the book where they just were in very dangerous situations against the North Vietnamese Army, not effectively equipped, not effectively trained, and that did not turn out well.
We'd like to thank our great sponsors, Mack Weldon and ZipRecruiter, for continuing to support SpyCast. Remember, you can get 20% off at MackWeldon.com by using the promo code SpyCast. That's 20% off at MackWeldon.com by using the promo code SpyCast. And you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/first. That's ZipRecruiter.com/first. And you can get freshly dipped strawberries from Sherry's Berries starting at just $19.99 plus shipping, or double the berries for just $10 more. Go to berries.com and use our code SPYCAST. Well, Josh Kurlancic is a senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations. He is the author of the new book, A Great Place to Have a War, The Secret War in Laos, and The Birth of a Military CIA. I highly recommend it. Thank you, Josh, for taking the time to talk to us here at SPYCAST.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us on SPYCAST. Every Tuesday, we'll give you the most interesting conversations with some of the most intriguing people in the world of intelligence. If you'd like to send us a comment or suggestion, you can email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Or tweet us at @intlspycast. That's intlspycast. The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution. To help support future educational programming, please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.